Waller. I'm David Alkeck, and I'm going to be your MC tonight, filling in for our president. Just to start with a few little announcements. This is the Dallas Philosophers Forum for any of you who have, this is your first time. In fact, how many of you, this is your first time here? Oh, good, good, good. Well, where did you hear about us from? Where did you hear about it?
I'm not even sure.
I just looked it up online. I found it online.
Found online. And y'all?
I found online, signed up for the email list.
All right. Yes. All right. Thank you. Okay. This organization has been going on for about 45 plus years. And we discuss various things, not just philosophy, but sometimes economics, politics, religion, all kinds of science. And it kind of relates to philosophy. Philosophy is a love of knowledge, after all. And we do have our expenses. Philosophy isn't free. So if you haven't paid your $5 admission fee, see our treasurer, David, here. Students are $2, I believe, if you're a full-time student. Be sure to take care of your bill if you've eaten. Take care of your server. Please don't leave us the bill before you leave. And let's see. Oh, David, you have next week's or 2 weeks?
Yeah, we got through this semester, which doesn't go that long, but okay. But we have plenty of these.
Okay. We're going to take off for Christmas, of course, and so we have one more, I believe, this session. December the 11th is the Philosophy of Ancient India by Bill Bernstein. Then we'll take up again in January, and we've filled up our schedule pretty well for the what we call the spring semester. So we welcome you all to come back. Have a good lineup. Okay, so tonight we are really privileged to have Wynn Galbraith with us. He's given us talks here before. And he was born in Chicago. Cold city, windy city. Oh, I heard a story about why it's called Windy City, because one of the politicians, I think, a long time ago, was very, very windy in his speeches. It had nothing to do with the wind. Grew up in the United States and Japan. Went to college at MIT, which he started in physics, went to philosophy, graduated with a BS in philosophy and physics. Then got his master's in theology from Western Seminary in Michigan, served as an assistant minister for a while, and then decided to go to a new joint program at the University of Pittsburgh, which was a theological seminary, and acquired a doctorate in three disciplines: philosophy, history, and philosophy of science, and theology. He became acting chairperson of three departments, philosophy, history, and philosophy of science, and religious studies at a regional campus of the U of Pitt, and then left this and got another master's degree in information science. You went to school a lot. He became chief computer scientist at the Energy Impact Associates, which was a company producing environmental impact statements for corporations. Then moved into sales and support and consulting roles all over the U.S. With numerous companies. Finally retired in 2004. Whew, I think I would too. Join me and become enlightened by Dr. Wynn Goldberg.
Conceptual system for dealing with conceptual systems, sort of a meta-conceptual system. And this is something to allow you to analyze that
which you
analyze and synthesize that with which you might synthesize.
I need some volume back here.
No, Lynn, yeah, yes. You can get louder.
Louder? Yes. Can you turn it up?
Yeah, I'll turn it up.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Good.
More.
I think the mic underneath your lapel. It's up there. I mean, I can hear it real loud.
Don't hear it. Can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back? Okay.
It's okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to prove what I'm saying for reasons which will become obvious as I proceed. But I will give arguments in favor of what I'm saying, and examples, lots of examples. I'm not just playing with conceptual systems, but there are some terms, things which follow from these conceptual systems that I'll be looking at as part of what I'm doing tonight. And I know that I'm, in some cases, adopting a minority position, so feel free to raise questions and argue about it afterwards. So I didn't want to be there, I want to be there. Here are some statements that tend to rise a little ire in most people, I think. The last one on the bottom there, that's not Trump talking to Mueller. That's Trump talking to a reporter who asked for, you know, did Trump have any proof of the things he was saying about bad hombres in the caravan coming north. But I'm going to argue that all of these are plausible. Now, that doesn't mean acceptable. I'm just saying plausible. So we'll see why they are plausible, and then how you can tell the difference between merely plausible and acceptable, perhaps. If we're going to talk about conceptual systems, we have to start with concepts. And the first bullet point here is a quote from Wikipedia's article on concepts. And it tells us that concepts are mental representations, abstract objects, or abilities that make up fundamental building blocks of thoughts and beliefs. I want to add to that that these are actually processes. They're not just objects, not things so much as verbs. Their processes and connections within the brain. Now, I know that in saying that, I'm foreclosing on the metaphysical discussion about the relationship of brain processes and consciousness. And I think that's okay because it's not really material that much to what I'm saying. But I do think that doing something like this gives me, through neurological research, some Ariadne's thread to follow to figure out some other things about conceptual systems. And incidentally, I want to point out that concepts are not the same thing as words. We do use words as tags for concepts, but they're not the same. One way we know that is that for any given concept, there may be multiple words. And for any given word, there may be multiple concepts. So as a result, it's a many-to-many relationship. They're not the same. Another way, another argument for that, is that non-human animals have the same brain processes as humans do, but they don't have language to speak of it. So obviously in that case, and again in the case of babies, they don't have a language to speak about things that they do conceive. And I'll say more about that later. Most of these are unconscious. Let's see. There we go. Now, a conceptual system is a system of concepts. It's a bunch of concepts that are related to each other somehow. It's a taxonomy to be used in interpreting sensations into perceptions. It used to be said that perception was first and concept was later. And in some instances, that may even be true. But a more modern approach is to say that there is raw sense data in the brain, and that this then causes a stimulation of locations in the brain which actually are concepts. And these concepts then interpret what you see. And that's the perception. So when you have a perception, it's because the sense data has been interpreted by a concept. We'll see some examples. So I mean by a conceptual system, a collection of related propositions. A proposition is a linkage of two concepts, such as the earth is round. It can also be just round earth. That too is a concept. And so I'm using the word concept at several levels. There are levels of concepts. It's a hierarchical system. And we can have that concept hierarchy at a variety of levels. Just an example, if you see some roses on a rose bush, you can talk about the roses at one level, you can talk about bushes at another level, you can talk about biological entities at another level, plants or things, just multiple levels. If you get a high level conceptual system, you've got what's called a worldview or a Weltanschauung. Thomas Kuhn used the word paradigm for these high-level conceptual systems. One of the problems that he ran into is that people said your use of paradigm is ambiguous because we don't know what level you're talking about. I had the same problem with conceptual systems. Wittgenstein used the term language games, and of course he's talking about language. But the language corresponds to a set of concepts, a conceptual system behind the language. So it's the same idea of conceptual system game. Okay. I distinguish conceptual systems from ideologies. An ideology includes a conceptual system, but it also includes a stubborn insistence on holding that conceptual system. And it generally also implies that a lot of people ought to accept that same conceptual system. Maybe everybody in my tribe or everybody in the world should believe this stuff. So let's look at a couple of examples of conceptual systems. First one is Aristotle's Physics and Astronomy. And I'm going to read these things to you, and I'll comment on them later. Every entity has an essential nature, which includes its natural place and natural behavior. It also includes the goal that it has and how it will develop into that goal, etc. So an acorn is an oak, you know, in process. Objects have two kinds of motions, natural and forced. Untouched objects in motion will come to a halt, either by reaching their natural position, that's part of their essence, is a natural position, or because they run into something, or they dissipate the motive force. The Earth is located at the center of the universe. That's because the essence of Earth is to be at the center of the universe. The Earth is stationary. It doesn't move or spin. If it moved, it would violate the essence that it should be at the center. The moon, planet, sun revolve about the Earth. And below the orbit of the moon, there are four elements: earth, fire, water, and air. From the moon out, everything is made of ether, which is a quintessence, a fifth essence, which is perfect stuff. We don't see any of that down here, but it's fit for heavenly things. Earth moves down toward the center of the universe. Water does too, but not as strongly, which is why you find Earth underneath the water every time. Fire moves up, air does too, but not as strongly. That's why you see the flame shooting upwards, and also the surface of the earth is not on fire, because air doesn't move up as strongly as fire does. Ether moves in circles about the center of the universe because circles never end and are therefore the perfect motion. Now, these things hang together. They kind of imply each other. I'll go on to some comments on this system. Until sometime in the 1600s, this was the dominant scientific conceptual system. Aristotle's concept of a science was not, by the way, that it gave you certain knowledge, but it gave you practical knowledge. Science was began like a foundation of intuiting the essence of something. And once you grasp the essence of something, then you could deduce everything that you might need to know about it. For example, all men are mortal, that's part of their essence. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. You can, by deduction, arrive at your conclusions, and that's science. He had good empirical reasons to accept each piece of his conceptual system. For example, the earth is stationary. It fits together with the other pieces of his conceptual system. But we know that the earth is stationary because if you step on something that's moving, you can sense its movement. And if you stand on the earth, you don't sense its movement. On top of that, if birds are flying high in the air and the earth were moving, the birds would get left behind, which doesn't happen. And if you think that, well, that's because the air moves with the earth, excuse me, there's also the planets, which are not in the air, okay? They're in ether. And if the earth moved, then those planets circling the center of the universe would be left behind. And that doesn't happen either. So, obviously, the Earth is at the center of the universe and it stays put. And similarly, had arguments for everything else. Every single one of these scientific assertions is now regarded as false. And not a single one of those 11 points that are acceptable today. Example 2. One version of fundamentalism. God created a perfect, harmonious world and placed the first humans in paradise. Man sinned against God and thus shattered the relationship with God, and the whole world's harmony is lost. So man has a suffering and pointless life. But God said that God loved the world, and especially man. So he sent his only begotten Son as a man to take away the sins of the world and reestablish the possibility of a happy relationship with God. Now, if individual men will accept Jesus into their heart, they have the opportunity to live a blissful relationship with God forever. It is another conceptual system. Comments on this. The individual statements hang together similar to Aristotle's. There's a story here. And if you take out one of the parts, the story has a problem. Some of these statements have some sort of empirical or historical evidence. We have written evidence that there was this man Jesus, that he said he was from God, that God loves man, etc. And then there are some people who say, well, hey, we've got evidence that Noah's Ark was found on Mount Ararat. That sort of thing. And people say they have evidence of this conceptual system because prayers are answered. Every one of these ideas is still regarded as undeniable truth by a large number of people. You may notice a difference here between a religious conceptual system and a scientific conceptual system. A few characteristics of systems, conceptual system. The first two points relate to the relationships between the parts of a conceptual system. And those are basically two sorts of relationships. They hang together. There's a mutual implication. Or, in some cases, there's a deductive relationship. You know this because of that. And you can deduce that from this or whatever. The second point here is that a major source of meaning in relations is, meaning the concepts, is due to the relationship of the concepts. An extra-systemic, that is, from the system to the outside, there is supposed to be a relationship. So we think, we claim, that there is an external world which also gives some definition to the concepts. And the ostensive definition of that's a dog, that's a cow, that sort of thing. And conceptual systems have a purpose or a use, which is why they're adopted and sometimes how they're evaluated. They and the concepts within them are dynamic, change with time and personality. They're not certain. Now, this is a controversial issue. The conceptual systems are not certain. The concepts support each other, but as a system, they float in a sea of uncertainty. More on that topic. This is an argument by analogy between language and concepts. We say in English that the unit of meaning is a sentence, it's not a word. So the unit of meaning in a conceptual system is the whole system, not a particular concept. Most of us would say we know the meanings of all but one of these words. And the last word, rabbit fruit, is one I invented for the demonstration. So it doesn't have any meaning. But I'm going to say that we don't actually know the meaning of all those words. Because we don't know the meaning of ramifuge, we don't know the meaning of some of the other words. For example, what does largest mean with regard to ramifuges? Well, if a ramifuge is a spool of fishing twine, then it's probably the longest twine. If it's a drill bit, it'll be the fattest drill bit. If it's, if it's a unit of currency, such as a dollar bill, you have $1, $5, $10, $100, then it's not physically bigger. It's the same size as all the others. But in terms of value, it's bigger. It's larger. What about lend? What does lend mean if you're lending a ramifuge? Well, if a ramifuge is a roll of toilet paper, you don't want to buy it. Same thing with a banana. But you might accept a compensation of another one similar to it. If a ramifuge is a $100 bill, you'll probably be happy with two $50 bills. But if I'm your son, you may not get it back at all. So lend has a different meaning there. What about the word your? If I'm asking for a bulldozer or a 747, I'm probably talking to a representative of a company, a corporation. And your doesn't mean your personal 747. It means your corporate 747. So there's ambiguity there that comes from the ambiguity in the word ramifuge. And similarly, you and me, what kind of person lends a ramifuge? What kind of person borrows a ramifuge? So how do conceptual systems relate to the external? This is the other thing. Presumably something going on in the brain correlates to something going on externally. But what's in the brain is a network of synapses. And there's a couple of hints in here. I underline the word network to bias you in favor of what comes next. because it is in the brain, it is a network. It's obviously so. It can be broadly representative. Concept doesn't look like, sound like, taste like, smell, feel like the noumena. There's a word that I'm tossing in. Let's go look at the, not that one, that one. The noumena is on the right, the phenomena is on the left. These terms were introduced by Immanuel Kant, 1781, Critique of Pure Reason. You'll notice that the phenomenal house is not exactly the same as the noumenal house, on top of which the noumenal house presumably has corners. The concept in the brain does not have corners. I had to represent it this way. It's hard to represent something without a corner on a flat sheet. Also notice the downward pointing triangular brain process over here. Doesn't correspond to anything existing at all over here. That thing doesn't exist. But we still have the concept for it, the representation of it. Now let's go back. Not every concept needs a touch experience. If we're talking about an electron, for instance, you may not be able to experience an electron. But if a lot of them are moving at once, you can experience that. So it can tie together with something that is something experiential. And every conceptual system will have anomalies. What do I mean by anomalies? The conceptual system, which represents some external reality, doesn't operate the same way the external reality does. This is because the conceptual system is a model. And the thing about models is that they're not the things that are modeled. If the model was just exactly like the model, it wouldn't be a model. So since it's different from the model, it will behave differently under certain circumstances. And consequently, there will be anomalies. There will always be anomalies with a conceptual system if that conceptual system is intended to represent something external to itself. Now here, I'm trying to point out that if your concept, as you look at this, is of a mammal or a rabbit, you'll see a rabbit. But if your concept is bird or duck, you'll see a duck. Okay? And maybe you can flip back and forth. This one is known as the illusion of the spinning dancer. Some people see her turning to the left. Some people see her turning to the right. I have even heard somebody say, no, it's not either. The left and right sides of the image are doing this. Okay? All of those are wrong. Nothing is spinning here. You can actually see the watch this spin for a while one way, and it'll turn around and spin the other way for you. Okay? Because that's your mind building this. Or I could say brain. It's your brain building this. So let's look at some models of conceptual systems. They come in two categories, two types. Foundationalist and coherentist. And I'll show you some drawings for each of these. Here's the basic model for foundationalism. It's called foundationalism because there's a foundation down here of fundamental or basic foundation ideas or axioms. Something that is indubitable. Something that can't be denied. Something that's intuitively obvious. That it would be a contradiction to think otherwise than that. And if you can find that, hey, great. If I ask you why you believe A, you're going to tell me, well, maybe B. And if I ask you why you believe B, you're going to tell me C. But this can't go on forever. At least, not intelligently. There are people who think it does. But so we want to find, under foundationalism, we want to find a foundation for our belief system. but what I did was introduce what's called the problem of regress. In other words, we regress from A to B, from B to C, and so forth, until we hit some solid foundation, some indubitable something. A good example of this is Euclid's elements. Euclid starts with five axioms and deduces volumes and volumes of geometry. Okay? Interesting note, in the early 1600s, both Descartes and Hobbes had very similar experiences, not the same time, same place, but the same experience. They walked into a room where a copy of Euclid's Elements was open, and Descartes says, he looked at the page that it was open to, and he said, that's impossible. But then he spent some time going over the proof, and said, by God, it works. That's how you should build a system of thought. Okay, you start with something indubitable. And for Descartes, that becomes the cogito ergo sum. For Hobbes, it becomes motion of three types, of particles, of humans, and of states. And then he tries to build an entire system on that. The real problem is, nobody's ever found something that was that indubitable. We all now tend to think that both Euclid and Descartes and Hobbes were wrong in thinking that they had found something indubitable. So, what kind of solution do we have to this problem of regress? There are basically three, even though I've got more here. The three are evidentialism, which is the idea that you will find some basic belief that you can build your system on. By the way, system builders like this kind of approach. And this approach, foundationalism, has been the dominant approach to conceptual systems and system building in general for the last 2,500 years. However, it is failing now because primarily the problem of regress and some alternative ways of looking at things. In 1961, I ran across the writings of Cornelius Van Til, who was a theologian at Princeton Theological Seminary. And he was pointing out that secularists, all of them, had a failure because of this problem of regress. They could not come up with anything solid to build everything on. But Christians didn't have that problem because they had the revelation of the Word of God. They even have it in a book. Okay, so how do you know that that book is the revelation of God? Well, you know, in trivial ways they say, well, it said so. But this is really not acceptable. So how do you know that that's right? Well, for Van Til, the Holy Spirit works in the lives of individuals to convince them that this is the Word of God. So it reveals to them that this is the revelation of God. It's a revelation to support a revelation. But then how do you know that that's a revelation? You need another revelation to show that that revelation is a true revelation of revelation, and so forth. So what we do is we end up with the same problem of regress, only now it's regress of revelations. Infinitivism is the idea that you don't have to have a foundation, just go on forever. Very few people want to hold a position like that now. Another possibility is to say, well, some beliefs are defeasible, i.e. they might be wrong. But if that's the case, then you don't know what of that system that you've built is true or false, right or wrong. And a third possibility is to say, I know A because of B. I know B because of C. And I know C because of A. But now you've got a circle. It's circular reasoning. Okay? And if circular reasoning, you don't know whether it's accurate or not, whether it's true. It is coherent. It is consistent. But is it real? Maybe not. And so finally, there comes the rejection of the whole approach. Forget it. Foundationalism doesn't work. This I just threw in for humor. This is the infinitivist position. It's turtles all the way down.
Yeah, but that's a converging series, actually.
Yes, instead of being a triangle with a point at the top, the pinnacle at the top, it's this way. But it's still, this is the foundation. Everything is built on that. Actually, this is the sort of thing that you'll find as a frontispiece for, not this one, but something like this, frontispiece for science books in the Middle Ages and the early modern times. They typically had a picture of the tree of knowledge just to suggest that, hey, we have a good foundation. Richard DeWitt published a book this year, 2018. It's called Introduction to the History and Philosophy of Science, in which he says conceptual systems should be, by the way, CS, conceptual systems. I get tired of writing it. They should be viewed as puzzle pieces that snap together and reinforce each other. Prior to that, 1951, in fact, Willard Van Orman Quine had suggested that conceptual systems or belief systems should be seen as a web of beliefs. The individual pieces support each other, but loosely. And see the slack lines in the spider web. And on top of that, so here's belief A, belief B, oops, belief C down here at the bottom. And individuals who use something like this can go out and revise any of these nodes, maybe chop them out, but spiders do. Or if a stone comes through and knocks out some of it, then the rest of it's still there, still hangs together. I like this picture because if belief systems should be viewed as networks, this one kind of reminds me of the cerebral cortex, the white matter over the gray matter. This is a better diagram. because it's more abstract. It doesn't suffer from peculiarity of leading astray, perhaps. Interesting point here is that, well, there we go. If you take the central concept, the red one, out, you still have conceptual system. In fact, you might have two conceptual systems because these two in the bottom left form their own conceptual system. And I like this. I like that I put this picture in because my own concept of conceptual systems is that instead of this more or less rigid network, the concepts are loose. They move. And you can stretch or compress. You can unhook, etc. You can rehook, experience conversion, whatever. Okay? Just by rehooking the concepts together in a different way. Now, so far we've talked about ideal images of conceptual system. What's real is big booming confusion. All kinds of things going on. Lots of different conceptual systems, some of them conflicting with others. People sometimes have watertight compartments, you know, believe this over here, but believe that over there. And they're totally disparate, disagree with each other. That's okay. Because they haven't tried to put them all together in one system. But of course, if reality is this big, booming, confusing mess, you know, why should our conceptual systems be any more ordered? This is more real. So what about strengths and weaknesses of these views of conceptual systems? Under foundationalism, if you make a change, and if you make it down at this basic level, there's a good chance you absolutely destroy the whole system. Over here, this system, you can throw out a concept without changing the whole thing. Over here, you think that you have solid foundation and you know for sure. Over here, you don't know for sure. You just have these concepts, which may or may not be useful. And so there are different strengths and weaknesses. I'm inclined to believe, I think I've more or less said this already, that over here, these things don't really exist. And as a result, this is a bad way to look at things. But it is, up until quite recently, the normal way of looking at conceptual systems. But I ask you, for your own conceptual systems, look into your own mental processes and ask yourself, do I have fundamental axioms that are the basis of all of my beliefs? Or is it more like a network of thoughts that tie together somehow? So about networks. And the new model, everything is networked now. Computers are networked. Artificial intelligence is networked. Learning theory is networked. Politics is networked. Economics is networked. Social media is networked. Everything is networks now. So networks is a new model for practically everything. And it's appropriate, I think. It's much better than what we've had before. We can have lots of networks, disjointed, some contradictions, that's okay. And if we go back to, let's see if I can go back here. In this picture on the right, if the concept or the proposition over here flat out contradicts the proposition over here, that might not be a problem because I've got several concepts in between. For example, if I say something like, the sky is blue. No, the sky is black. Is that a contradiction? Well, no, because I've got these other concepts in here that say, under certain conditions, it's blue, and under other conditions, it's black. So what might appear to be a contradiction doesn't absolutely have to be a contradiction. Children have networks of concepts, not axioms, theorems, and lemmas. You talk to a child about his conceptual system, he won't tell you that, well, the fundamental belief is, thus and so, from which we can draw the following theorems. No. He knows things. And the change can occur at unexpected locations. I'll give you an example of this. By the way, this is why Popper's falsification criteria is not so good. It won't work that well. Because, as has been pointed out by Duhem and by Quine and others, a proposition never stands against a test by itself. It only stands against the test within a conceptual system. And if there's a failure, the failure isn't necessarily with that proposition. It could be somewhere else in the conceptual system. I'll give you an example. In 1958, James Van Allen hypothesized that at a distance of about 500 kilometers above the surface of the Earth, there would be regions of intense radiation. And so that year, they put up Explorer 1. And Explorer 1 had a Geiger counter in it to measure radiation. And they did, in fact, measure some radiation at the low altitude. But when they got up to the place where Van Allen said there should be intense radiation, they got no radiation. So some people were willing to say, well, you know, so much for that hypothesis, next. But Van Allen said, no, are we sure that it was all hooked up properly? Yes. Did it work? Was it working in working order? Well, yes, apparently. Well, pause for a second. Maybe the equipment was swamped and could not record the intensity of the radiation, and therefore recorded nothing. Well, to check that hypothesis, more robust Geiger counters were sent up in Explorer 3 and 4 and Pioneer 1. And sure enough, they found that intense radiation. So those are now known as the Van Allen belts, because the change can occur at unexpected locations. So where do these conceptual systems come from? Since Kant and cognitive science, we now think that the first draft is innate. Concepts such as space, time, matter, cause, self, orientation, location, these are all innate, built into the child. They're primitive versions thereof. And these are modified by and filled out by our culture, and then modified by our experiences and cogitations. Let me go on. Here's an interesting question. How do you go about changing the conceptual system of a large number of people? It's not a question of changing vote totals, but can you change the electorate by manipulating their conceptual system by a variety of means, such as fake news, fear-mongering, scapegoating, rallies, social media? The answer is yes, as we have demonstrated recently. The reality is, if you present a conceptual system with a good story, hopefully from a perceived reliable source, then people will accept it. And with rallies and tricks like chanting, etc., slogans, the acceptance increases. So what you can see is that it is possible to manipulate the conceptual systems of a large number of people. So is it possible to have two truths? Larry Loudon has pointed out that this is common for scientists to pursue several interesting theories while accepting yet another theory. Feyerabend has pointed out that competition between theories can show the weaknesses and strengths of both. Now, I'll talk about the light example. In the 1920s, there were two models for the propagation of light. One said light is a wave, and the other said light is a particle. And if it's a wave, it's not a particle. If it's a particle, it's not a wave. At least that's what they understood in 1920. If it's a wave, then you have to have something that waves, some media, like the ether. Okay? If it's a particle, the ether is going to be an obstacle at most, you know, at best. So what happened? Well, in the 20s, scientists tended to have both models and use both of them. If they were dealing with reflection or Compton scattering or photoelectric effect, they use particles. If they're dealing with diffraction, refraction, interference fringes and so forth, they use waves. So you pick the model that you want to use to get the end result that you want to get. Most of us have several inconsistent conceptual systems simultaneously. For example, most of us have a sense of cause and effect, which amounts basically to determinism. And for every event, there is a cause. And if we know what the cause is, we can anticipate the effect. But we also think that humans are responsible and that they have free will. So on the face of it, these two conflict with each other. And we use these two models, both of them, depending on what type of scenario we're talking in. And this, of course, can produce cognitive dissonance if you try to reconcile them. So what happens if you need to make a change? If you make a change in the fundamental idea over here, you're likely to blow the whole system. Over here, you can make a change relatively easily. Sorry about the darkness of this slide. I copied this off of a YouTube video. It's basically the outline of one of Carlo Rovelli's books. And what he's doing is tracing conceptual systems through the history of physics. He starts off with Aristotle has the concept of substance of four or five kinds. Descartes has a res extensa, extended matter. The chief property of matter is that it's extended. This is great for mathematics and geometry. It's terrible for physics. Newton described particles moving through space and time. Faraday and Maxwell took apart these particles and came up with virtual particles or fields and particles. Einstein, in his special theory of relativity, combined time and space to space-time, and then later, with the general theory, combined fields and space-time into covariant fields. Over here, he was inveighing against particles, saying you ought not to look at these things as particles, you ought not to talk about particles because they're really just fields. Quantum physics brings fields and particles together as quantum fields, and loop quantum gravity talks about covariant quantum fields. So we're back to one essence, one sort of thing, just like Aristotle. And Rovelli says things like space, time, particles, they're illusory. They're not there. It's the brain that manufactures them for us. But I like George Box's comment here. He was a British mathematician, died in 2013. Remember that all models are wrong. The practical question is, how wrong do they have to be to not be useful? So, alternative facts. The way most people operate is summarized in the same perception as reality. And as perception is based on your conceptual system, what you see may be different from what somebody else sees. For example, is the spinner spinning left or right or not at all? Untested conceptual systems will be accepted as real. What you perceive as real is the idea, until somebody really challenges it. Your value system is fundamental and appropriate until suddenly it isn't, when somebody points out that there's a basic flaw in what you're doing. And this brings us to the concept of knowledge. What do we mean by knowledge? For the last 2,500 years or so, starting with Plato, we have tried to define knowledge as justified true belief. But since 1950s or so, the fellow Gettier came along and poked holes in this and demonstrated to all the philosophers that this is just inadequate. Knowledge is not justified in true belief. So there have been a lot of attempts, if justified true belief doesn't work, can we patch it up
by adding no false beliefs or no definitive causal link or reliability constraint. These are different theories of knowledge, okay? Different ways of trying to patch this up. There's a problem with it because actually, justified true belief, how do you know it's justified? How do you know that you have no false beliefs? How do you know that you have no defeaters? A defeater is some reason that somebody comes up with that totally destroys one of the reasons that you had to justify something. If there are no defeaters, well, how do you know there's no defeaters? Do you really know the causal links between what you say and what you might have observed? And how do you know that the methodology that you used is reliable? Well, all of these depend on knowledge, which makes it all circular. It's viable in a way, it's circular, but it is not viable because there's a basic problem with all of these, and that is that knowledge is not really objective. Knowledge is subjective. We know because it fits with our conceptual system, okay? We don't really know based on some sort of absolute proof. We don't have it. That's what we've been talking about in foundationalism and the failure of foundationalism. So there have been some late, recent possibilities of saying, talking about the primacy of knowledge, for instance. The word know is like 59 on the list of the 100 most common words in the English language. Every five-year-old knows what know is. You ask them about beliefs. No. Or lemmas, theorems, axioms. No. They know because they heard it. Because it's a part of their conceptual system. So if knowledge is primary and belief is derivative, then we may be going in the wrong direction trying to conclude that we can add something to belief. So if you don't know for sure, as philosophers around the world have insisted, then what sense does it make to say I know? Well, I'll tell you in a minute. I kind of already did. What about truth? There have been three major theories of defining truth. The correspondence theory, which says my proposition in my mind is true if and only if it correlates with what's going on outside my mind. But of course, we don't know what that correlation or correspondence is. So we have no way of knowing if it's true. Maybe there is no such thing as matter. Maybe space and time are illusions. What about the coherence theory? That is coherence again. It's the same idea, the network. It's true because it fits with my conceptual system. What about pragmatic theory? That is the idea that it's true if it works. If it's functional, it's good enough. I'll buy it as true, even if it's not. These last three are known as minimalist positions. The bottom one is redundancy theory. Says the word truth is totally redundant. It means absolutely nothing. If you say the word, the phrase, snow is white, is true, that's the same thing as saying snow is white. You haven't added anything at all by saying it's true. It's just a claim that you think so. So what do you mean by truth? Truth is, I jumped out of the third bullet here. Truth is what? Consistency with the rest of my currently accepted conceptual system. Hopefully it's going to be functional. What do we mean by proof? Well, a couple of definitions have been given. Deduction from premises, no numeric claims of value of truth. We've got a problem with truth already. So, you know, where did proof come? What happens to proof? We lose it. What about deduction from axioms? Now, axioms we can have. We can specify certain propositions that we're going to abide by. This is great in geometry, arithmetic, other forms of math. So far useless with regard to reality. As Einstein said, you know, if it's certain, it has nothing to do with reality. If it has to do with reality, it's not certain. But at the very least, what we mean by proof is coherence with our paradigm, our conceptual system. That doesn't give proof that another paradigm is incorrect, or that this paradigm is correct. It's just, well, this is the accepted one, this is the one we're using. And that is a matter of choice. As Kuhn says, the choice of paradigm over another cannot be resolved by proof. And the reason why that is so, we just saw it in terms of foundationalism. I'm going to zip forward. Guidance. Our goal should not be to know something, I'm concluding. Our goal should not be to know something and to prove it's true, but to find reasons to modify our conceptual system to produce practical improvements. And if you make a claim to a practical improvement or claim to knowledge, then you have the burden of giving some arguments in favor of it or some test of it. So when Trump says, you can't prove anything, there are bad hombres in the caravan, it's not enough to say you can't prove anything. You need to see some reasoning why he concludes that. Let's go on. We need to not be attached to a particular conceptual system, but vigorously pursue a more practical conception than what we already have. So, conclusions. Alternative truths are possible. What you see as truth may differ from what another sees. And Trump is right. You can't prove anything. Those are the first three statements that I started out with, their plausibility. But if we're going to use words like truth, fact, knowledge, proof, we need to recognize that we must first have a common conceptual system, one that is agreed upon between two or more people. And that is an ethical issue, to come to agreement, to work on some issue, some problem, and to build a conceptual system that is acceptable. It's a, possibly a social or psychological and economic issue, but it is above all an ethical issue. The communication of and about science, religion, politics, economics all depend on having a common conceptual system. And if you misunderstand the nature of conceptual system, you think some things are true, provable, whatnot, then you're going to have trouble communicating and creating educational systems, social action, etc. There's a difference between alternative truths and malicious lying. To lie about something in the way that most of us would say Trump has done is to make a pretense of a viable conceptual system. It's not a lie if, in fact, it is a viable conceptual system, which is then his responsibility to give some argument for. But if there's no viable conceptual system, then saying that there is, or suggesting that there is a lie. And that's how you distinguish between lies and possibilities. Misleading humans is easy. Abuse is too easy and immoral, but we could use it. I figured out, I'll stop there. Questions?
So where does the scientific method fit into this?
Wait a minute. Now that we know everything, there should be no questions. But just in case, you want him to clarify something, hold up your hand and I'll recognize it. Okay, we're good.
I thought it
was the quickest. What are you?
It's more of a relativist.
Say again?
It's more of a relativism than just ad infinitum coherent system.
It is a possibility that there is moral relativism. But if you have people of goodwill who want to work on an issue, they can come to an agreement, and then they will find that, you know, it's no longer a relativity, you know, a relative issue. Does that answer the question for you? It's an answer. I don't know if it's acceptable. It's another question.
Yes. You remind me of Socrates, who said that I know nothing
that I know more than anybody else because I know nothing and they don't.
Socrates was wise.
Anyway, if you say that snow is white, it's true, then what? If you can't say that, when somebody says snow is black, what do you say? You have to say it's false. So.
Well, you know, I noticed, I used to live in Pittsburgh, and the snow there in Pittsburgh is quite frequently black.
Because so is black.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so tell us about how scientific method interfaces with these thoughts.
Fire Robin said there is no such thing as a scientific method. Kuhn said something more or less similar. Yeah, there are methods to test things, but the problem is, how do you come up with a good hypothesis to test? For that, there is no method. There is only a method once you have a hypothesis, you can start to test it. But, you know, the most interesting part of science is the hypothesis. And, you know, since there's no method for that, I'll go along with Kuhn and Feyerabend.
Testing.
Yeah.
So, to get a little political, I don't want to get too political, but...
I did, why not?
foundationalism,
yeah.
Right, versus the U.S. Constitution. So, you said one thing that was very interesting. If you take away one of those axioms, one of those ideas, the whole thing caves in. So does that mean you can't amend... Constitution?
No. It doesn't mean that. What it means is you need a widespread agreement to amend the Constitution, which is, you know, the process of amending the Constitution requires that.
Yeah, but that doesn't go by what you were saying. You said,
well,
take one axiom away.
No.
It caves in.
It may. It may cave in. But the Constitution is not a list of axioms. It is a conceptual system, yes. And as such, it is not an absolute. And that's why we have to amend it every once in a while.
Yeah, an amend. What if you take away, like, the First Amendment or modify free speech drastically, like I heard?
Yeah, you could create chaos. Yes. And we may see it.
So, Wynn, do you have any thoughts about the impact of people's emotions on dealing with concepts and beliefs?
Oh, yeah. People want to achieve some end, typically, like find food, or have babies, or whatever. And they get quite emotional about these things. And the emotionality that they have can create an enthusiasm for a particular conceptual system, which is seen as the method for doing that. Somebody said, it is very hard to convince somebody of something when he gets paid for thinking the opposite. He has an emotional attachment to his job and the salary he gets, so you're not going to be able to convince him that the opposite of what he's saying is a better idea. Yes, emotions play a big role.
Yes, my question pertains to what I understand the problem with foundationalism, but is coherentism really that much different from foundationalism? I know foundationalism relies on one thing, and so with the destruction of that one thing, the whole thing comes down, which isn't the case with coherentism. But don't you really have to use foundationalism to come up with your beliefs for coherentism?
Yeah. No, the thing is, why does, are you having children? Why do your children think what they think? Not because they deduced it. Not because they knew what the foundation stones were and they built it up on that. No,
they have a belief system because that's what they hear. And they hear it because a lot of people have had some sort of experience which inclines them to believe that. So, yeah.
But they're relying on their experience. I mean,
yes.
You're still relying on things for your
yes.
belief.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's my point is...
Oh, yeah. There are.
You still have to use something to come
yeah,
up.
Yeah, but it's not foundational. Yes, it is. In a way, it's basic in a sense that I heard it. And therefore, I believe that and six other things as well. But it's not basic in the sense that it is an axiom, an indubitable entity that cannot be denied intelligently. Another question.
You mentioned emotions and other concepts. None of this stuff has any insane on unless you start with consciousness. There's none of this exists without consciousness.
Yeah. And some would say none of this exists without brain processes.
All right.
They're equivalent, basically. I say that, but I know some people would say, no, you can't do that. But I don't think that it makes a lot of difference. You can take everything that I said about brain processes out and just talk in terms of consciousness. You have the same result.
But without consciousness, there is no
That's right. That's right. But we have consciousness. Yeah.
Do we know that?
I think therefore I am.
No. That one doesn't work. Because we may just be a collection of processes going on. It's not a continuous process. It's this process, that process, another. Okay? Flash, 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 flash. Yes, there is flashing. But there is not a continuous self. At least that is a modern theory, and I think it's probably going to rule the day.
Buddhism. I have a question. Socrates had a problem with the sophists. The sophists of his day could argue one side and then turn around and argue the other side, and that was, you know, there was no real truth. Do you think Socrates was wrong?
In having a problem with the sophists. The problem that Socrates had is not so much that there were different opinions as that he didn't think they were very deep in presenting their opinions. And that, I think, is the source of Socrates' problems with the sophists.
With regard to your various conceptual systems, I think
diagrams thereof.
Some of them you, some of us use, some of them part of the time, and other part of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we try and get as much coherence as possible. Now, with regard to scientific knowledge, I would say that we form these concepts based on empirical observation, and we try and find a model that fits them. But the model doesn't really have any foundation. What we're doing is going down and down and looking for more and more fundamental aspects of reality and simpler aspects, if you want to use field theory or quantum gravity. And we're looking for the foundation, and we'll accept it if it seems to then allow us to deduce all the other higher-level things, and you know, from particles and fields to atoms and molecules and complex molecules and biological systems and brains and ability to make models of what comes in through experience. So it's a combination of those two conceptual systems and many more. And I agree with you that it's imagination that is the foundation for a change in the conceptual system. And then the history of science is littered with abandoned hypotheses. But the ones that seem to fit into the existing model and maybe lead to a change deep down in the foundations are the ones that are going to be accepted.
You know, paraphrasing George Box, all the conceptual systems are wrong. But how wrong do they have to be before they're not useful?
No, that's not right. They're not. All conceptual systems are not perfect.
Yes.
But how close to perfection do they have to be useful?
Not very close.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
And yes, you know, incidentally, in that picture, the young lady with the buzzing confusion above her head, we do all have foundational approaches, network approaches, and maybe some other things too. Some loose ends that, you know, we just tend to buy.
Maybe for social relations, much more so than for physical relations.
We have a question here.
Okay.
Just for clarification, I thought I just heard you say there's not a concept of continuous sense of self. And I remember myself as a child.
No. No, there is a concept, but the concept doesn't necessarily relate to anything real. You watch the spinning dancer spinning the left, but did it really spin? No.
So what are you saying to me, that when I looked in the mirror at 4, I'm not...
You're a different person than you were at 4.
Well, I'm a different person every moment, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're also the same.
What does that point mean, though?
Well,
I have a concept of myself from the beginning to the end, so what does that point mean? Then?
You have a concept of self. You have a concept of self because you're born with that innate inclination to believe in yourself for self-preservation. If you didn't have it, you might not be so active in preserving yourself. And you wouldn't leave, you know, progeny. In which case, people who thought that way would die off quickly.
How do I know any concept is real, then? If you could just say, what I know is not.
You don't know that it's ultimately real. That's the point.
I win.
Oh, I.
It seems to me that you are arguing for a practical philosophy and a practical science.
Yep.
And that is exactly what the sophists would have argued for as well.
Aristotle too.
And
for that matter, lots of other people.
That we don't know what Socrates said. What we know is
Plato's version. It's Plato's version, yes.
Socrates.
Yeah, well, when we say Socrates, we mean Plato's version thereof. Yes.
Exactly. And I think I was sitting here marveling at how much this actually did sound like the older sophists. So I don't think there's anything that isn't deep about them.
Yeah, well, I know that's debatable. I think if you can easily come up with both sides of an issue without spending some significant amount of time thinking about it, it's not deep. It's probably not going to be that deep. And I think the sophists really weren't that deep. And that's what... that's what Socrates was upset with, at least as Plato records it.
We have
more than one
question.
More than one.
Follow-up.
That depends on where you get your knowledge of what the older sophists were about. You have to remember that the medievalists destroyed most of their writings, so a lot of the deep stuff is gone.
But then it becomes a problem to say what the sophists thought at all. I don't find that this is an indication of how we should proceed.
I think, going back to a point that you made, that knowledge is what our brain makes of it. Mm-hmm. Truth is what our brain makes. It's the concepts that our brain makes. So that it comes down to, you know, is it useful? You know, is this the same solid, or is it just you know, fields of electromagnetism? You know?
Might be either, but or both.
So our brain,
or neither.
Our brain,
but if I can put my glass on it, that's okay.
Is that all right? Last question. Any takers? All right.
The question I have is, as science has all these paradigms, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have biology, you have psychology, you have physics, chemistry, all these different paradigms that seem to interact with each other.
And contradict each other.
Right. But as technology gets more advanced and we're able to quantify science using mathematics, do you think eventually we'll start having axioms that can be applied across all the different paradigms? That the mathematical models will prove to be reliable.
There is a problem there in terms of finding the ultimate axioms. If you find the ultimate axioms, then you're going to stop looking, because you have found the answer. You know the truth. There is no point in proceeding any further. And if that's the case, then Einstein would not have been given a chance. A lot of what we would call progress in science is simply ruled out as irrelevant, because we already know the answers. Don't bother looking, because I know. So we don't ever want to arrive at this ultimate absolute knowledge.
God plays with dice.
Thank you.